My name's Tim Calvert, and I am a member of both Laughing Horse Books Collective and the Portland 9/11 Truth Group. And I've had the pleasure, yesterday I picked up Paul from the train station with a bike, and he very gamely, instead of just your typical, oh, I'll pick you up in a car thing, I took a bike on a trailer, and we rode all around yesterday, and it's been really wonderful getting to know Paul. And I'll just do the more official introduction here, too. I think I'm looking forward to the discussion at the end, and I think there's a lot to talk about, of course. Paul Zaremka is a professor of economics at the State University of New York at Buffalo. He's been the general editor for Research in Political Economy since 1977, and is the author of Towards a Theory of Economic Development, editor of Frontiers in Econometrics, there we go, and co-editor of Essays in Modern Capital Theory, and he is the editor of this volume. He wrote a couple chapters in here on insider trading and... Anyway, he'll go into it more. He's got very familiar with 9/11, obviously, and the variety of theories here. We've warned him that the Portland group is a pretty hard-bitten group. A lot of you already are pretty far along in this entire underworld of the U.S. politics, so he's aware of that as well. And so without too much further ado... Paul Zaremka. All right.
Okay, well, thank you very much for inviting me. And I guess the first thing I'd like to know is I have to kind of test the audience. I just came from Humboldt State College and gave a talk and found out the answer to this question, two-thirds of the people said they knew about it. And I want to see how many people know that there was three towers that went down on 9/11. Does anybody not know that? And that tells me that I had two-thirds there and I have 100% here. That tells me you're at least fairly informed. And that leads to my first comment about myself. When 9/11 occurred, I am not like what Tim tells me. There are some people in this audience who immediately put on the DVD and recorded all the news broadcasts about 9/11 on 9/11. And that means that they are already very sensitive to what's going on, and I wasn't. I'm not saying I bought into the government, but I didn't reject it either. I just was basically absorbing the event. And the next two or three months, I mean, I guess I was still absorbing the event, but without moving with it, until I heard that Michael Rupert was coming and giving a talk in Toronto, which is only 2 hours away from Buffalo. And a friend of mine drove up and heard his talk, and that said to me that basically I had to understand 9/11 for my own. And I consider myself a scientist, and I wanted to do it in a scientific way, in a way which I think confronts the evidence about 9/11. And the end result of that was that I started researching particularly on the Internet about 9/11. But what's interesting is the very next issue of the Research in Political Economy, which came out in 2002, I wrote it already included two articles about 9/11, not written by myself, not an insider job or anything like that, but just people who were doing issues connected. Peter Dale Scott, for example, issues connected to 9/11, but not directly on 9/11 itself. And I wrote a preface in October of 2002. This is now like 9 months after I started doing some serious research, and I did not know that World Trade Center 7 had come down. Okay, so yeah, I think the real lesson is how much the media can hide from us, even people who are watching these things. Now, maybe I just missed it, but I did. Okay, so. I was getting interested in 9/11 for the following years, and maybe around 2004, 2005, some faculty members, like about 40 of us, were on a list, and somebody suggested that we do an edited book on 9/11. I had an opportunity that I could provide to them. I said I could offer them the publishing outlet of the Research in Political Economy. The publisher is Dutch. It's a very well-known academic publisher named Elsevier. They've never given me any, I mean, I'm doing Marxist stuff. They've never given me any hesitation about anything I publish. So I was quite sure that I wouldn't get any problem with this particular issue, and I didn't get that. I mean, they did a wonderful job on it. So I offered that, and we moved forward, and there was, you know, twists and turns, but the end result was in 2006 to publish the hardcover edition of this book, which actually cost $100. So not many people except libraries bought it, and maybe, you know, 100 extra, right.
No,
and a few other people. Okay. But prohibitive, okay. And I know one of the reviews on Amazon was 5-star for the book, it was 0-star for the publisher because it was $100. But that's every issue of Research and Political Economy is $100. So, I mean, I'm not, it's a research publication. So that's the way they are in academia. The big step was to get it out in a soft cover edition, which is now about $15 on Amazon, $20 in retail. And that's being published by Seven Stories Press. Seven Stories Press is a progressive publisher. Some say the most important progressive publisher, independent publisher in New York City, which is not inconsequential. They've done also a marvelous job with this publication. But they were also the one who published another book on 9/11 by Noam Chomsky, okay, who dumps on 9/11. So the fact that they put out this book after Chomsky's book, okay, I think says something about we are making progress, okay, that our issues about 9/11 are getting increasing exposure. So that's what I want to say, and then I'll just comment about the book itself. This edition, the soft cover edition, is better than the hardcover edition because, first of all, we have an update in the back of it to some of the chapters, and these updates contain sometimes essential new information, nothing contradicting anything, but essential new information. So that's important, and there's some typos that are corrected, not a whole lot, but enough to make a difference. And also, I have a new preface in it, and also David Ray Griffin offered 16 reasons to be concerned about the government story about 9/11, and it parallels, if anybody knows about it, that Bertrand Russell did the same thing on the Kennedy on the Warren Commission. And right before the Warren Commission was reported, he does 16 reasons to question the Warren Commission report, and some of the stuff is just as remarkable today as it was when it was written, 35 years ago, whenever it was. Okay. So having said that, there's 4 chapters which deal with 9/11 itself. One is the first chapter is about the hijackers, which we're going to be talking about when we look at this first sheet here. I'll only spend about 5 minutes on that. The second thing is my own chapter, which is on what actually happened to the planes on that day. And I'm going to bore some of you, I don't know. But I'm going to try and do a detailed analysis of what I think, what we know about what happened that day and what we don't know about what happened on 9/11 itself, at least from what I can glean from the evidence. And also I'll look at insider trading. I mean, that's my background in economics. I even was a specialist in econometrics, which looking at put option trading is something that I'm quite prepared to be an expert at, if you want to put it that way. The third chapter is by David Ray Griffin on the collapse of the towers. The fourth chapter is on war games. I don't know if I'm speaking too fast, but I'll slow down as when we get to more serious stuff. The fourth chapter is on the war games that took place on that day, and I'll also give a new story I have about a game played that day that perhaps most people don't know about. And then I will do four chapters, one by Nafez Ahmed, who did some of the very first books on 9/11, and he's looking at whether Al-Qaeda is any kind of independent agent, or whether it's just a list of names on a computer sheet in the CIA and nothing more than that, which is kind of where I'm coming down from. We have another one on Machiavellian state terrorism, which suggests that the United States is just another state and it can do Machiavellian state terrorist acts just like other states can do. And that's written by a Canadian author, and in Canada they have actually proof of that in an incident that occurred in Canada. I won't be talking about that, though. The next chapter is on the 9/11 Commission report, and not so much all the members, but at least some of the members, including Philip Zelikow, who is the chief executive, the executive director of the 9/11 Commission report, and the background that he has. And finally, there's a one chapter on Islamophobia written by a woman who is examining the connection between Israel and the United States neocon movement in the United States going back for about 20 years. Okay, let me start by, first of all, referring you to the sheet here, which has a picture of one of the more important, I mean, if there's anybody who is a more important alleged, I always say alleged, hijacker, it would be this one. This is the alleged pilot of the plane that went down in Pennsylvania. What this picture was done was compiled by the author of the first chapter, who is discussing who the alleged hijackers were. This is seven photos of Mr. Jara, who is supposed to be the pilot of United Airlines 93 that went down in Pennsylvania. If you look at the pictures carefully, and six out of seven of them are official, some government official photo, driver's license, a passport photo, and a visa, whatever. I mean, six out of seven of them are official documents about this guy. And if you look at it, I think you'll see probably three different individuals in these pictures. Maybe more, you can argue it, but about three different individuals, all with the same name, and that means that this individual has a double. This is very important, okay? A double means that somebody else is going. There's a real human being who happened in this case not to be from Saudi Arabia, but happened to be from Lebanon. There's a real human being running around the world with that name, but there's also somebody else also running around, at least one other person running around with that name. I'm not going to go into a long discussion. It's in the first chapter of the book. But I will add on here that his uncle was given an interview, and I heard the tape of it, and I don't know how to describe except just to say it in my own words. He seems like a normal, serious, likable human being, okay? Talks naturally, whatever. He said his family, when they said that Mr. Jara was his nephew, was piloting this disastrous plane, this criminal activity, the family gets together and tries to figure out if that's remotely possible for this person. And none of them in the family could come to that conclusion. The most they could come to was that maybe by accident, he decided to take a flight from Boston to Los Angeles because he wanted to have some fun over the week, over a week or something like that. But that's the farthest that they could go. They don't know if he's on the plane, but if he's on the plane, it's not for any kind of act of hijacking a plane. And as I say, I can't say more than just, if you listen to it, it just sounds like if anybody here had a member of their family being accused of that, that's the first thing you would do. You would be asking questions about, is this possible? Okay, now that's the other thing I wanted to say. No, he's not alive. Okay. However, one of the things the first chapter does is we have 19 alleged hijackers. The day after 9/11, the government puts out 19 names. They find out that one of the individuals is already dead. They substitute four names, not that one and three others, four names for the first list. That new list comes out about 3 days later, and there's been never any change in the list since then. One of the things that gets me so angry is that the 9/11 Commission report just reports the list of the names and doesn't prove in any kind of criminal fashion that the list is correct. This is in spite of the fact that the director of the FBI himself says that we can't prove that these are not stolen passports or doubles or whatever. I mean, he himself said we can't prove it. And yet the whole world has changed around this list of names which they can't prove. And then that leads to your question. that Mr. Jara, who wrote the first chapter, did a careful analysis of all the evidence about each of the individuals, and something, he gets that 10 of the 19 were alive after 9/11. 10 of 19 were alive, stated to be alive somewhere in the world by The Independent, by the LA Times, by BBC, by a Saudi newspaper whose name I can't remember.
Identified six of them.
So there's a lot of names out there, and the minimum the 9/11 Commission report should have done was to be interrogate every single one of those stories. Okay, and they didn't. I mean, that's an outrage. I don't want to say more about the hijackers. You can go to it in depth. I want to go into in depth of the things that I went into depth about. And that has to do with what actually happened on 9/11 in terms of the planes. And then I will, after that, do with a more esoteric topic of the financial issues of put option trading before 9/11. I'm hoping that there are some people sufficiently interested in that they'll bear with me while I give some commentary about that, because it was a major story, at least for a while. If you don't mind, turn now to the oversheet. There are some people who say that no planes took off at all. The whole thing was a total fraud. I mean that American Airlines flight American Airlines flight 11, United Airlines flight 175, American Airlines 77, and United Airlines flight 93 in order I've just listed, that none of them were real planes. So I told you from the beginning I try to do this scientifically, just try and figure out every aspect of what we can find out. And so one of the first things I did was try and say, can I be sure that the planes took off? Those planes took off, just took off, okay? And my answer is yes. Now, the reason why I come to that answer is, I mean, I can go through some of the evidence, but there's no reports of anybody who is supposed to be a passenger on that plane phoning anybody by cell phone or by regular phone saying that my flight's been canceled or diverted or something like that. I mean, there's whatever the list of the people who were, I mean, there were for sure flights scheduled that day, and there's no reports that people said that my plane didn't take off. And if they weren't boarded on the plane, you would expect them at a minimum that kind of information to be passed, to be gotten out. I have other things to say about that, but that's enough to say about that. Let me now turn to the basic flight information, which is table one on the sheet here. Sometimes we forget sort of like how close the flights were in their scheduled takeoff and what actually happened what the industry calls wheels off. Wheels off means when they left the pavement of the runway. The scheduled departures run from 7:45 to 8:10, 25-minute interval. Now, put yourself in the position of being a planner for this operation. Could you be sure that the planes would take off?
Yeah.
Could you be sure the planes would take off on time?
No.
You cannot, obviously. Okay. Now, I think that's extremely important information. Okay. If you think this is such a highly skilled operation from 19 alleged hijackers, you know, coming out of wherever, okay, they'd have to take account of problems that would occur during that day. And indeed, a problem did occur, at least it seemed to be a problem that occurred that day, and that is the wheels off for United Airlines Flight 93 takes off at 8:42, that's on the fourth column, at 8:42 from Newark Airport. That is actually 43 minutes after the wheels off for American Airlines 11. And then we get to the issue about the issue about when there was evidence that there was something going wrong. I'll call it hijacking, but without saying that it's these hijackers, because I'm also going to come to the issue about whether there really was hijackings or not, or something like hijackings, without caring about the names of the people. So go to the table 2, and you'll see a column called Hijacking Time and Transponder Turned Off. And you'll see that the hijack time for the first one was flight American Airlines 11 around 8:14, and the transponder being turned off at 8:21. That's 21 minutes before United Airlines 93 even leaves the pavement, even his wheels off. Okay, so even that was enough time to shut everything down, okay? Not even let the plane take off the ground, let alone let the plane fly for another hour and 20 minutes after 8:20 to before crashing in a field in Pennsylvania. So that's connected to the war games issue of why there wasn't interceptions of any of these planes, or if there was an interception of the last plane, the one that crashed in Pennsylvania, why isn't it acknowledged as such? And maybe I'll talk a little bit more about that also. Okay, so we have the planes taking off. Now, the reason I put this on the screen is as I try to photocopy, the photocopy simply doesn't show you the flight paths. Even in color, I just couldn't get it to come out, so I had to have it on a screen here. And I want to show you these the flight paths, because we sort of forget. The American Airlines Flight 11 goes up here. By the way, and the website I got this from also has this animated, so you can actually see the planes when they cross each other. And I would have preferred to have that available, but we just don't have it available on this computer operation here. United Airlines goes up here, it makes a turn around somewhere around here where it's going off its normal flight path. And then makes a sharp turn here and goes straight down into the north tower of the World Trade Center. And it goes into the building more or less straight on. That turn is, and somebody is, a lot of people in the 9/11 movement have done really careful research. Somebody got a map of the whole eastern part of the United States of where the radar coverage is from all the airports. And there are holes in the radar, places where one radar doesn't overlap another radar coverage. And what he found out is that every strange event that occurred with these planes occurred in a hole in the radar. What it all exactly means, we can discuss further, but it's putting the map over it, these are all holes in the radar. So that's a hole in the radar, okay? There's also a plane coming down here that maybe have some role that we're not sure about. Anyway, the plane goes down here. If this was animated, you would find out that this plane, that these two planes, the Flight 11 and Flight 175, United Airlines, they cross each other almost exactly. I mean, they're in the same place at the same time. And the same place in the same time is over an Air Force facility. I forgot the name of which one here. This is over Griffiths Air Force Base, which sometimes I pass actually when I'm in New York State, in that portion of New York State. And this is another name of some Air Force facility, which both of which have buildings which have no glass in them, and you know anything can be going on inside that. The second plane goes around, and curves around like this, and it crashes into the World Trade Center at 9:03. That's now already 43 minutes from the time that they know that there's something going wrong, okay? So, for sure, even if you can excuse the fact that military planes did not intercept the first plane, which it could have happened if they had proper procedures followed, that could have happened. But even if you excuse the first one, you can't excuse the fact that there was no interception of the second plane, at least as I see it. Although the government now spends time excusing the whole next hour, you know, until the plane crashes in Pennsylvania. Now, before I get to the hijackings in a little bit more detail, I just want to mention about the second crash into the tower. It goes into the South Tower, not straight on, but a little bit to one side. And yet all three towers Tower 1, Tower 2, and Tower 7 all come down at free fall speed on its own footprint. So that suggests the question that even if you would somehow think that the government's story about what happened on 9/11 in terms of the collapse of the buildings had some credibility, you would at least think that World Trade Center 2 would have fallen over on its side or somehow not gone straight down on its footprint, because the jet fuel went out, because the jet hit on one side of the building and the jet fuel goes out on into the air, like about half of it, more, I don't know how, something like half of it. Furthermore, that raises the question about why the second tower, World Trade Center 2, goes down first, collapses first, and the North Tower collapses second, about a half hour later. That's another strange thing. World Trade Center 7 collapses in at 5:20 in the afternoon, and that's much later. Now I'll let me talk about the hijackings for a second, and then I will I'll go to what I think. This is now speculation about what I think actually happened to World Trade Center 7 in connection with 1 and 2. The transponder, I'm listing here when the transponders were turned off. Some of the transponders actually were turned back on. The United Airlines 175 went on and off twice. So there's definitely not just a switch off, but it being switched back on. That does suggest that somebody was doing it. Okay, so some people, like David Ray Griffin, don't believe that there was any, or at least he suspects there was no hijackers, nobody in the plane who took control of the plane. I think, and one of the evidences is that there's a certain code you can put into the transponder which sends off a warning signal, and none of the four planes had that code signal put in, suggesting that there was nobody there who was being hijacked, quote unquote. No pilot did anything to give that signal, that coded signal, that they were in trouble. Okay, but I think the fact that the transponders themselves came off is at least good partial evidence that something was happening inside the cockpit. The second thing is that on some of the planes. And now we can get into more speculation. Some of the planes had seemed to have direct human communications from somebody in the plane saying, "We are being hijacked." United Airlines Flight 11 had two stewardesses who made communications with people on the ground. Those have been provided by the 9/11 Commission report. I could spend too much time talking about the detail of it, but let me just say that one of those two was not recorded, but was told by other people. The other one was recorded for the first 4 minutes and then described thereafter. However, even in the first 4 minutes, there was explicit statement about hijacking, so it is supportive of the idea that there was actual hijacking, even if you are not comfortable with not having a recorded of the whole event. The United Airlines 77, which supposedly crashed into the Pentagon, had a woman named Renee May, who was a stewardess, who was reported to have said on a cell phone at 25,000 feet to her mother that the plane was being hijacked. Okay, now that's that's not possible. Okay, you can't communicate by cell phone at 25,000 feet. But I'm not so skeptical of the story, because maybe the story said cell phone, but it meant air phone in the plane. I'll mention Griffin. Griffin thinks that this is quite significant that many of these stories say cell phones. I don't think it's quite that significant. I'm a little bit looser on worrying about whether somebody could have said cell phone, but it really was airphone, with one exception, and I'll get to that in a minute. So that comes to the issue about another plane for which we have evidence, supposedly, of hijackings, and that's United Airlines 93 that crashed in Pennsylvania, the one that has the drama of the two or three commercial movies that have been produced about 9/11. That plane had a lot, supposedly, a lot of messages from people on the plane to the ground. And some of us, and I was quite skeptical in the beginning, some of us are quite skeptical that cell phones operated at the altitudes at which these people were calling from. And I myself took planes from Buffalo, went to Albany, which is kind of near the area where these things took place, went to St. Louis via Detroit, and I tried to do cell phone connections, and I couldn't. Okay, so it helped me to confirm for myself that it was not possible, except when you got to really low altitudes, then the connections were made. So I am of the persuasion that cell phone communications above 1,000, 2,000 feet are not possible. However, after the Moussaoui trial, which occurred shortly after the first edition of this book came out, so it's covered in the second edition, but not in the first edition, the one you've got here. The Moussaoui trial, the lawyers produced a detailed statement about which of the phone calls from United Airlines 93 were cell phones and which were air phones. And to a lot of our surprise, they claimed that every phone call was an air phone except the last two. The last two being around 1,000 feet elevation off the ground. So it's actually possible. Okay. So that's, if it's correct, if the FBI is reporting honestly about those phone calls, and I have some skepticism about it because nobody's producing records from phone companies. Yeah, I mean, either, nobody. Okay. I mean, the family members, nor the FBI, nor, you know, nobody's giving us phone records. And I know my phone record. I can learn about every phone call I make on a cell phone if I want to. Okay, so why isn't? And I assume the airlines would have the same records about air phones. And if air phones require credit cards, it'd be the same thing. Yes.
Some 9/11 researchers previously inquired with American Airlines.
Right.
Whether or not they carry CPAC phones in the 737 models, and
their
response was that they don't.
Right, but then there was some other. I think there was some follow-up to that, which left in my sense of ambiguity. That I'm not mentioning that. I'm not taking sides on that one way or another. Okay. However, there's one exception. The one, and which is really a dramatic contradiction with the government. One of the women, Dina Burnett, I think, says that she got cell phone calls from her husband in a book published before the 9/11 Commission report, before the Moussaoui trial comes out. She says it was cell phone. She says, I looked on my phone and it was Tom's cell phone. Okay, and she says it more than once in the book, in print, in writing. And the government says, and she says there was four phone calls. The government in the Moussaoui trial says there was three phone calls that they were air phone calls and that they were not the same time that Dina Burnett claims. And that's a glaring contradiction. I do not know how to solve it. I mean, that's still United Airlines 93. Okay, that's the one. That's the one. Right. United Airlines 175, there were no phone calls from that plane. There were some other phone calls from 11 other than the two stewardesses. I'll just pass over because we can't do everything. But from two passengers. Overall, I would say that there's enough evidence for me to feel comfortable of saying that there was someone in those. Something was happening in the cockpits that was not normal, at least for three out of the four planes. So I'd rather... I go on the side that there was some kind of human intervention in the cockpits, but having nothing to say about whether the named individuals that the government names are the correct names. I don't go with that at all. Okay, I wanted to say something about the collapse of the towers, which connects to how the planes got to where they were. I said that the plane that goes from United Airlines 93, which goes up and comes down, comes straight. if you look at the, any of the pictures of the plane hitting the tower, it's at an angle, right? It's not straight on. It's coming like this. If you look at United Airlines 175, it's also not going in straight to the south tower. It's coming in like this in the south tower. I think it's the opposite direction away from the other plane. Eric Hofschmidt has produced a book shortly after 9/11, which has great pictures of what possibly could, and this is speculation, of what possibly was actually happening that day. If you put a beam in World Trade Center 7, it could be beamed in such a way that the plane coming from the north is caused to bank into the north tower in a way which, by the way the beaming would work, would come in with that kind of angle. And the same would be true of a plane coming around, like 175 was coming around, going into New York City, but from the south side. If they had a beam which was beaming the pilots into the targets from World Trade Center 7, that's what would have happened. That suggests that World Trade Center had the evidence of what was truly happening on 9/11. World Trade Center 7 had the Securities and Exchange Commission in it, okay? And a huge amount of, I mean, I know somebody who worked there who day after day, I mean, they had to write down case closed, case closed, case closed, because they had no duplication of SEC records outside of that building. So when that building collapsed, like thousands of cases were lost, okay? That's one thing. FBI, CIA, Secret Service all have operations in that building. Giuliani's bunker was in that building, okay? And so perhaps this beaming device was also in that World Trade Center 7.
Just to be clear on what you're saying, you're talking about military-style laser target designation stuff, right? Is that basically what you're talking about? When
I actually,
target with a laser beam and then the missile flies into the target?
No.
No,
I wasn't talking about that. I was talking about the possibility that the possibility that the planes are not doing anything much different from an automatic pilot landing procedure that you do almost every time you fly anywhere. Okay, but I don't know if you use a laser beaming. I don't think that's what you. I was thinking more commercial airlines, but instead of guiding the plane into a landing, you guide it into a building. Okay, that's what I'm thinking of. We do not know anything, and nobody knows anything about the last 10 minutes inside the cockpit that I know of. Okay, I mean, there's nobody. The government can't prove that any pilot was doing anything. I can't prove any pilot was doing anything in the last 10 minutes. So that, even if there had been interventions in the cockpits, it doesn't tell you that who was ever in the cockpit was having any control whatsoever of those planes. So I think it's more likely that some kind of non-human intervention caused the planes to do what they did than a human intervention. Because if I were a planner for these events, I would not trust an individual to guide the plane. First of all, they're bad pilots, but even apart from that, I wouldn't trust people to go through it and complete such an important operation into a building. Let's see how we go. Oh, we're running pretty deeply into the time, but I have to say one other thing. Why did World Trade Center 7 then go down at 5:20 rather than at 10:15 or some other time? My thought is that there was a mistake occurred. Something happened in the electronics that was trying to bring that building down, and it didn't work. And it took them a while to get it back up in working procedure. And by that time, they could no longer disguise that the building came down in free fall fashion. They probably would have hoped that it would have occurred while all the dust from the other buildings was blowing in the air and would have disguised what happened in the World Trade Center 7. I had another remark I wanted to make about that. That the building 7 was 47 stories. It was not a building next to either World Trade Center 1 or 2. It was a building away. There was either World Trade Center, I can't remember which number, but 5 or 6 or 4 in between 1 and 2 and 7. Those buildings did suffer damage, but they didn't collapse. Okay, you see damage of the buildings. That's, and this building, which was further away, collapsed in free fall fashion without any plane hitting it. It's not believable. That's simple as that. Okay. Okay, let me now move on to insider trading because I'm running out of time. I see my notes here. I do want to mention that no manifest of persons on the plane were obtained from either American Airlines or United Airlines. Only the passenger list was obtained, but not the names of the people who were supposed to be the hijackers. Those manifests were never released. When family members of the alleged hijackers offered DNA evidence, the government refused to even accept checking out the DNA evidence, even in spite of the fact that for the plane, for example, that went into the Pentagon, they claimed they got all but five of the passengers' DNA correctly identified, okay? Something similar for the Pennsylvania crash, even though both of those planes were supposed to have completely disintegrated. About half of the people lost in the two World Trade Centers, DNA evidence was confirmed that they were really there, but they didn't check any of the alleged hijackers. Okay, so let me then go on to insider trading. Now, this is now a financial issue. Insider trading generally means, and there's many different ways of doing this, you know something in the future is going to take place. You know it before the market knows it. Okay, and you engage in a transaction which is going to take account of a future event that other people don't know. And you profit from that insider knowledge. That's insider trading. It's illegal. One common way of doing insider trading would be if you own a stock, you simply sell it. In other words, you're the president of the company, you're CEO of the company, and you sell the stock when you know something is going to happen in the future negative to the company. That would be, there's restrictions on that, but that's just selling what you already own. But what we're talking about here is selling what you don't own and taking advantage of it. All of you can do this, okay, if you want to do it, if you got the money, okay? This is called a put option. A put option is a contract at the Chicago Board of Trade, which allows you to, for example, sell American Airlines stock or United Airlines stock 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, even a year in advance, or any time in the next year or next month or next 2 months, sell it at a certain, what they call the contract price, okay, of, let's say, $30. I say $30 because that's the price that the stock was selling at in the week before 9/11 for both of the companies. So think about it. If you know it's going to happen and you figure those stock prices are going to go down big time, then you might want to write a put option contract for $30 where it's not suspicious. I mean, it's sort of like where things are at, okay? You buy a contract, and what happens is if you want to take it, you don't have to take advantage of the contract. It may cost you $1 a share, 50 cents a share for $30. So if you don't exercise the contract, then you lose $1 per share. You buy 100 shares, you lose $100, okay? But if you do exercise it, then what happens is that you buy the stock on some future date and immediately sell it. I mean, at the same second. I mean, the two transactions are happening at the same time. But you're buying it at 17, which is what the price went down to. You're buying at 17, and you sell immediately at that contract put option that you had written a month before at 30. So you make $13 minus whatever your 50 cents a dollar was for each share. So you make, let's say, $12 a share. That's how you profit from insider trading.
Who buys it at 30 at that time?
No, you have written a contract a month ago that somebody's obligated to buy it from you at $30. That's a contract. This is somebody called a market maker. It's somebody who works at the Chicago Boards of Trade, makes their living off of these contracts, okay? Because sometimes they work, sometimes they don't. When they don't work, you just simply lose your dollar. You lose your dollar, and they do a lot of it, and they make their living that way. Okay, I mean they make a good living that way. Okay, So that's the answer to your question. It's the person who wrote the contract. If I can write a contract for you right now, I mean, literally, I write a piece of paper selling that you have to sell me let's say ING, the contract, which is a company. Okay, ING is now selling around 3.5. I write a contract review for $5 for 1 month, anytime in the next month, and it's selling $1 in a month from now. You still have to pay me $5 for the stock. That's, you're giving me a put option, but it's not being done through the Chicago Board of Trade. It's a private transaction, and you can go. I can go to court if you don't honor the contract, and you can't just say I walk away from it.
Somebody's taking the loss.
Okay. And of course, if 9/11 never occurred at all, then you wouldn't have, it wouldn't have happened. You wouldn't have made the profit in the first place. Okay. So you're the insider portion of it is, you know, the future event is happening. Now, here's what I think happened. It got a lot of attention right after 9/11 for about 1 month, and in Barron's Financial Weekly, in some financial publications, it was given considerable attention. A mainstream story. Suddenly, it stopped. I think what happened is that the people who know these data saw what was happening, saw that there was millions of dollars that could be made. Maybe even they even said billions of dollars were being made in insider operations before 9/11, and they thought we will be able to put a fingerprint on Osama bin Laden. I mean, literally. I mean, I think that they thought that it was that they would point right to Osama bin Laden, because they didn't know. Okay, and that it would point to him. And it was a great way to fingerprint Osama bin Laden's outfit on 9/11. However, the story fell apart. I mean, it fell down, and I think it fell apart. And I think what happened is that the word went out that it ain't going to go there. It ain't going to go to Osama bin Laden, so just stop talking about it, okay? I don't know how that exactly that happened, but
It went to the wrong person.
It went to the wrong, right. Right, exactly, right. It went to, and I mean, I've seen a video interview of one of the head, one of the former, I don't know what they call it, the executives of the Chicago Board of Trade, that they can identify who did these transactions. Even if it's offshore, they can, still identify who did the transaction. So it's not a big deal, okay? So the story dropped. The 9/11 Commission report, it has one sentence and one long paragraph about what, I mean, they just basically say it was, there was some unusual trading that occurred that day, but it was innocuous. I mean, that's the word they use. It's innocuous trading. And they give some explanation of it. I can read it and we can talk about it, but I'm running out of time for details like that. The important thing that I do want to talk about is I want you to see what the problem is and what the scientific evidence is about insider trading that went on before 9/11. I don't know the names because I don't have access to the names of who did it, but where we would go to look for the evidence. On table 3 on the same page that you've been looking at, you'll see the closing prices of American Airlines and United Airlines on the days before 9/11 and then what happened after 9/11. You'll see that it's around $30 and drops down to $17, $18 for both of the companies. Yes? That's the first person whom I would subpoena if I had the subpoena power, okay? The reason why he mentions that name is that he was a former director of international operations, I believe it's Deutsche Bank, and then that was taken over by another bank, or I can't quite remember, but he was a very high official, third-ranking official or something like that in Deutsche Bank, involved in international operations, and then moves over to third-ranked position in the CIA. Okay, and that's where he was on 9/11. So there's an obvious, that's an obvious person, too, to check out. Krongard, K-R-O-N-G-A-R-D.
Right. Yeah, right. Right. Okay.
First name, his nickname is Buzzy, but Krongard.
Intimately connected to Blackwater.
Yeah. Excuse me?
Intimately connected.
Right. His brother's involved with Blackwater, I believe, right? If I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, he found that out over lunch break.
Yeah, right. Yeah, right. So the closing prices and the volumes of the transactions are in table 3, and then in table 4 I put down the volume means how much trade was occurring. So in table 4 I'm giving, and this is a rather sophisticated, I mean you have to read this table carefully, but I'm copying it from the book, and I give more detail in the book. But just for fun here, I mean, let's look at the second to last column. The second to last column says United Airlines, $30 or any contract expiring 10/20. Now, what that column says, and once I explain that one, you'll know what all the other columns means. What it means is that how many hundreds of trades in United Airlines put options of exactly $30 or any other price for expiration on October 20th. In other words, you have to do it before, on or before October 20th, and I give, there's more than one price available in the put option market. $30 is an obvious one to point to because it's the same price as more or less it was trading beforehand. So I put that with special attention, and then I mention any other contract. So what you see here is that on October 4th, there was no put option trading in that stock, and zero, okay? The next day, just a little bit. Then suddenly there's a big jump on September 6th, which is, of course, 5 days before 9/11. That would be the Thursday before, and there's only 2 market days after that, Friday and Monday. So it's 3 market days before 9/11. There's suddenly a big jump, okay, most of it in at the $30 price, and a little bit of extra, but most of it at $30 price. And then it falls back down to this small level on the Friday. It gets a little bit larger on the following Monday, but not very much. So the big attention would be September 6th on United Airlines put option stocks. And that's now reflected in the graph on the first page, which shows you for both American Airlines and United Airlines the jump in the volumes of those two put option trades before 9/11. And compares it to the total outstanding shares of put options for each of those stocks on the Monday's September, at the close of Monday, September 10th. However, this is scaled 1 to 5, just to get it on the same chart. So basically what this is saying is it looks like almost like 20% of the total volume that occurred over the last year and a half or 2 years before that occurred in a couple of days before 9/11. Okay, so then, yeah.
How does this correlate with other airlines at the same time?
The other airlines did not experience it. Only these two airlines, okay? And there are other companies that experience the same thing. We could talk about that, too. I'll just mention
related
them.
Industries.
Related industries. Related to the World Trade Centers 1 and 2, okay? Now, the question is, the scientific question is, how likely or unlikely are these events? As I said, there was dramatic reports that these are highly unlikely. One report says that these volumes are 90 times normal. 90 times normal volumes. Okay, big time stuff. Okay, so the question then becomes even for random events, there are sometimes outliers in random events. So you can't just say because it's large that that's the end of the issue. That proves the issue. It doesn't quite get there. Okay, so the scientific question is how probable is it that these could have happened? Now, there's a professor in the University of Illinois Champaign named Podosman, who is, I don't know if he's apolitical or whatever, but he was given confidential data from the Chicago Board of Trade about the actual levels of put option and put option volumes on these stocks in the days before. And I know this is Greek to you, but I should make a qualification. When people talk about put option volumes before, they talk about the ratio of something called put options to call options. call options are the reverse of what I've been talking about. I don't want to elaborate, but it's the reverse. And they talk about the ratio of those two as being dramatically high on that day. Okay. The problem is that you, if I, let's talk about you again. Okay. If you wrote me a contract, if I buy a put option from you, later you could sell that put, anytime, you could sell that thing back to me if I want, or you could sell it to him. Okay. So if that takes place, that's included in the data of a put option trade on that day, even though it doesn't reflect any overall increase in the number of put options on that day. And this ratio of put options to call, and this is complicated, but the ratio of put options to call options is not that clean a data, because it doesn't take account of that possibility of selling what has already been sold. So the data this Professor Potisman got was cleaned up of that problem. Furthermore, he did extensive, I'm an econometrician, and I know what he did, but he did a complicated econometric procedure to figure out the probabilities that what you're looking at here is likely. The answer is, for one of the airlines, this is his new statistical answer, 99% in one airline case, this is due to insider trading. 99%. In other words, there's only a 1% probability that it could have occurred on a random basis. The other airline was about 87%. If you put the two together, then it's even less than 1% probability that it was not insider trading. In other words, there's overwhelming evidence that on a statistical basis, not on the basis of you know who did it, but on a statistical basis, it's in fact insider trading. The other funny thing that's interesting about this is that that was published, but it was published in 2006. But it was already available. The research was available when the 9/11 Commission report was writing. So if they had been on the ball, at least they could have checked out that evidence and said whatever they wanted to say about it. But they completely ignored it. There are also, and the other thing I want to add, yes.
Does the volume the put options, does it represent a significantly high traded amount of a few individuals, or does it represent a larger group of individuals trading in smaller trades?
Well, we have some evidence about that, because one of the stock reports does report that these 2,000 transactions that I just mentioned was all done on the same day in blocks of 500. So it was 500 trades. It could have been the same individual doing it through different agents, but we don't know that. But I'm saying it's not piecemeal. At least that was not piecemeal. That was large trades. Okay. I don't know about the other one.
It's likely that it was a very small number of individuals?
Yes. Right.
Yeah. Isn't there an oversight committee called FinCEN that looks at every option trade? Yeah, I mean, just the FinCEN. And they could, if they wanted to, go in and find
yes.
who did this trading. And
that's what
I mean, FinCEN must have been compromised at some level, too.
I mean, maybe I'll mention, just since you asked, the 9/11 Commission reports, not about this trade, but about the other trade, explains it away as follows. This is the trade that occurs. No, the one. This is American Airlines trades on September 10th, the day before. On September, on American Airlines, most of them was done the day before. Okay, that's on this chart here. That's the lighter colored of the two vertical things. The 9/11 Commission reports explains it away by saying that there was a financial newsletter which faxed its membership a recommendation to put a put option on American Airlines the next day. It does not say that any the commission does not say that it went to the list of the people who subscribed to that newsletter and did what they were recommended to do. They did not say that they even made that minimal check, nor did they provide us the name of the newsletter so we can check out if the newsletter really did do that. In other words, no, there's just their assertion, and that's it. And this is common throughout the 9/11 Commission report, is this kind of fluff. Okay.